Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, this is Annie and hello Tobias, how are you?
Yeah, good morning, how are you?
Yeah, and it is quite a good morning. It's warm outside but chilly in the studio, but hopefully we'll warm the cockles of your heart today on Solidarity Breakfast on 3CR, your community radio station. We're going to start off with some headlines. I've gathered a few. New Zealand's High Court rules against the state's superannuation fund, that's NZ Super, over its investments in companies implicated in Israel's human rights violations, setting a precedent for sovereign and pension funds investment across the world. The complaint filed by Palestine Solidarity Network, Aotearoa, PSNA, emerged out of the NZ Super's refusal to divest from Airbnb, Booking.com, Expedia and Motorola. This win is a testament to the key role BDS partners play in holding complicit governments and institutions accountable for their failure to honour their legal obligations under international law. You might have been aware of the Homeless Persons Union's of Victoria's pushback against the City of Melbourne's community services offices after it was revealed in a recent article in The Age that these community service offices were being encouraged to use force when moving on rough sleepers and confiscating their belongings. There's an update to this. After interviews on the ABC local radio with the Homeless Persons Union Victoria spokesperson Patrick Spike Cipollone, followed the next day with Melbourne City Mayor Nick Rees, the mayor has invited the Homeless Persons Union Victoria to a meeting midweek. We will catch up with Spike and Kelly next week on Solidarity Breakfast around 8:30 p.m. for an update. The union is not taking the foot off the pedal, calling for people to come to the Melbourne Town Hall for the Big Lean, Tuesday, 12th of May at 5:30 p.m. As they say, everyone has a right to the city. Shove the CSO program. And to follow up from last week's look at AI and its supposed wondrous work future for humanity, but actually jobs are being slashed left, right and centre, Disney, the parent company of Marvel, announced layoffs of 1,000 members of the comic property's staff in both New York and California. This reportedly includes the artists, designers and other creatives who brought the Marvel Cinematic Universe to life on the big and small screens. One's concept artist and illustrator, Wesley Burt, shared the news of his layoff on X, where he wrote, "The irony of having a one-on-one HR layoff meeting in the conference room with my Loki mural on it, accompanied by an eye-catching floor-to-ceiling image of Tom Hiddleston as Loki on the conference room wall." Burt's IMDb page notes that he worked on MCU films like Black Panther, Avengers, Endgame and The Fantastic Four, First Steps, and has won three Art Directors Guild Awards for Excellence. The reason the Walt Disney Company announcing the massive layoffs is to streamline operations, in inverted commas, according to a memo from the new CEO, Josh D'Amaro. The cuts will affect about 1,000 employees across all arms of Disney's media holdings. One division basically what they're going to do is use AI, because I know this is hard. D'Amaro wrote in a memo to employees, "These decisions are not a reflection of their contribution or of the overall strength of the company. Rather, they reflect our continual evaluation of how to more effectively manage our resources and reinvest in our businesses."
Well, it's interesting that I've been doing a bunch of reading on the history of the modern take on the European Union. And in the 90s, UK communists, Alan Woods was writing about how it was just a ploy by the European bourgeois to expand its capital markets all across the nation states of Europe. And the first coin that was minted for the euros was actually one with the figure of Scrooge the Duck. Just to show how tied in the Disney franchise and is to capitalism, and how emblematic it is of capital expansion in the world.
Well, it's interesting because if you did further reading around these artists that were working for Disney, they actually conceptualized the entire franchise, you know, all the very well known iconography that goes with this incredibly lucrative franchise, the Marvel Comics realizations. They weren't given direction; they created it. So now they're saying is that now that you've done the work, we'll now get AI to do all the illustrations. People are saying that people should drop their Disney subscriptions.
Yeah, and this is something that we're seeing sort of mirrored around a lot of these new or newer digital industries, with Rockstar Games firing most of its development staff for its the latest iteration of the Grand Theft Auto games just months before it was due to be released. After all the hard work's done, the staff are to see no payouts for all their hard work.
Yeah, it's pretty outrageous. We should move on to other news. You will have seen that the mainstream media is kicking off with reports that in Alice Springs that there's been protests and violence around the really quite horrible death of a 5-year-old child. But as a sort of a backgrounder, I mean, because TV loves a bit of violence, doesn't it? But
decontextualized violence.
The Northern Territory government boycotts federal youth justice inquiry. So, I mean, they're obviously being a bit disingenuous. I mean, Lydia Thorpe put out a release talking about act of contempt, Northern Territory boycotts federal youth justice inquiry. The Northern Territory Attorney General, Department of Children and Families, Department of Corrections, Department of Education and Northern Territory Police were among those invited but did not attend this particular inquiry. No ministers, departments or agencies affronted the inquiry, Senator Thorpe has said. This amounts to an act of contempt. It is completely unacceptable that the Northern Territory government has boycotted this inquiry and refuses to face scrutiny. It's fascinating, isn't it? So on one hand, they squeeze people to a terrible level and refuse to actually cooperate with community building or take responsibility for their actions. And then they go for photo opportunities on mainstream news for violence.
Yeah, and it exists in the larger context, of course, of the Northern Territory intervention.
Yeah.
When we see prominent spokespeople for Australian mainstream media supporting false claims that there was this moral panic that was created around the safety of children in the Northern Territory that manufactured the consent to be able to go into indigenous rural communities and destroy the fabric. And so when we spoke to friend of the show, Maluma May, she was saying that this is the context that all this exists in. So all these, supposed youth gangs and violence and everything is the product of successive government policy failures and of legitimate...
I have to say it's intentional.
Yeah, it's intentional. And the animosity that's felt towards Northern Territory Police can't be understated after the killing of... people in shopping centres after the
25-year-old a couple of weeks ago, a 25-year-old guy.
Yeah,
died.
The police officer that shot a person getting away scot-free. So the anger at police is tangible and it is legitimate, even though the media might not like you to hear about that.
Yeah, well, let's move on to the global Sumud Fertilla.
Yeah, so as everyone would have seen, they've been attacked. I'll just read from their statement from April 30th. Piracy in plain sight. Israel abducts multinational civilians on the open sea. Israel's actions tonight, Wednesday 29th of April.
Oh, before you get to that, play Zach Schofield's. He was on the boat. He's one of the people that's been gathered up. And this is from his voice, from his Instagram feed.
All right, well, here on Eros, we are still sailing as part of the Global Sumud Flotilla, but we're seeing reports from Israeli media that they are claiming that they're starting to intercept us. Now, we're nowhere close to the claimed territorial waters of Israel. We are still west of Crete. And what is really terrifying about this is that it's yet another example of Israel breaking every single international law in the book to starve Palestinians and continue their genocide of the Palestinians. If they are seizing us here on the high seas, that is so clearly an act of kidnapping and piracy under international law. The question is, will any of our governments take action against them? And yeah, there are drones above us and in front of us. The question for the Australian people should be, how can we be allies with a country that is willing to break every single international law in the book to arrest and imprison and detain humanitarian volunteers on a humanitarian mission, literally 2 weeks' sail from Israel itself? It's genuinely unprecedented. But Israel has a history of doing things that are genuinely unprecedented to Palestinians.
That's the voice of Zach Schofield.
They're 1,000 kilometres away from Gaza.
Yeah. I'll just read from the press release. Israel's actions tonight, Wednesday 29th of April, mark a dangerous and unprecedented escalation. The abduction of civilians in the middle of the Mediterranean, over 600 miles from Gaza, in full view of the world. Let's be clear about what this is. This is piracy. This is the unlawful seizure of human beings on the open sea near Crete, an assertion that Israel can operate with total impunity far beyond its own borders with no consequences.
Well, Navarro Media sent out a release. The Global Sumud Flotilla was attacked last night by warships, drones and speedboats full of heavily armed Israeli commandos despite sailing just off the coast of Greece, more than 500 nautical miles from Gaza. Of 57 boats at sea, 22 are believed to have been intercepted in the attack, which began at around 11 p.m. local time. 35 others escaped interception, with many sailing into Greek territorial waters. Around 170 participants are believed to have been detained and are likely being taken to Israel, several days' sails away. Others were left stranded at sea. In a statement, GSF described their situation as a calculated death trap. After smashing engines and destroying navigation arrays, the military retreated, intentionally leaving hundreds of civilians stranded landed on powerless broken vessels directly in the path of a massive approaching storm. Organisers initially assumed that all intercepted participants had been detained. Many activists posted pre-recorded videos to their Instagram accounts saying that they had been taken hostage. But with systems down and the phones thrown overboard, it is possible some are actually adrift and unable to communicate. In October, the IDF pirated flotilla boats and sailed them back to Ashdod, but Israeli commandos reportedly found this challenging because they got seasick and didn't know how to sail. The journey then was only hours long. This time it could last several days. It's interesting because Elhad Haq commented that about the response from the Israelis. Israel's Minister of Defence smeared the international humanitarian activists travelling on the flotilla, stating that the flotilla was, inverted commas, organised by the Hamas terror organisation in cooperation with additional international organisations and under the guise of a humanitarian aid flotilla. A statement from the Israeli's Minister of Foreign Affairs warned that, inverted commas, the driving force behind the flotilla provocation is Hamas, joining hands with professional provocateurs with the aim of sabotaging President Trump's peace plan transition to its second phase. Due to the large numbers of vessels participating in the flotilla and the risk of escalation and the need to prevent the breach of a lawful blockade, early action was required in accordance with international law. But the flotilla, composed of activists and human rights defenders, are undertaking a peaceful mission aimed at delivering humanitarian aid and challenging the ongoing siege and blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip. As widely affirmed in legal analysis and expert commentary, such flotillas constitute a form of non-violent and humanitarian expression. The detentions evoke serious concerns under international law, particularly regarding the protection of peaceful protest, humanitarian actions, and the treatment of civilians involved in solidarity endeavours, along with Israel's previous and serious inhumane treatment of flotilla activists. Israel's actually not in accordance with international law. Blockade of Gaza, which has been going on for decades, is an illegal action.
Yeah, and last month was the anniversary of Vittorio Aragone. We reported it on Radio Philaf, who was one of the first people to get through on the flotilla to Gaza, and was subsequently killed by militias thought to be linked to Israeli special forces, Mossad. But what we've seen, especially in countries like Italy, who have, I guess, more of a direct connection, being connected by the Mediterranean, but also with much broader campaigns building on the solidarity with the boats, we've seen that over more than 200 mobilizations have occurred in Italy around the flotilla being raided, and that's led to people being just normal students being side by side with workers that are under government attack, similar to what the CFMEU is under administration here. And they've been taking city squares all around Italy in protest of this.
The people are calling for... they alerted people that this is what was happening yesterday, people were asked to ring Penny Wong's office. But of course, if you rang Wong's office, which I did, there was a recorded message, and they were saying things like, we get a lot of calls, and so we can't answer all of them. And you can put it in writing if you've got concerns, da 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 da. So the advice was actually that you should go to your federal minister's office and make your feelings known.
Yeah, and another anniversary that fell this week that I'd personally, something that is important to me, is singer-songwriter Paolo Pietrangeli, who sang a song in the late 70s talking about protest movements in Italy at the time. And I want to just play a song now where it highlights this link. The chorus has a popular chant which links the students next to the workers all taking the city squares in response to the crimes.
Roba contessa all'industria di Aldo, han fatto uno sciopero, quei quattro ignoranti volevano avere i salari aumentati, gridavano pensi di essere sfruttati, e quando è arrivata la polizia, quei quattro straccioni han gridato più forte, di sangue han sporcato il cortile e le porte, chissà quanto tempo ci vorrà per pulire. Compagni dai campi e dalle officine, prendete la falce e portate il martello, scendete giù in piazza, picchiate con quello, scendete giù in piazza, affossate il sistema, voi gente per bene che pace cercate, la pace per far quello che voi volete, ma se questo è il prezzo, vogliamo la guerra, vogliamo vederti finir sottoterra, ma se questo è il prezzo l'abbiamo pagato, nessuno più al mondo deve essere sfruttato. Sapesse contessa che cosa m'ha detto un caro parente dell'occupazione, che quella gentaglia rinchiusa lì dentro di libero amore faceva professione, del resto mia cara di che si stupisce anche l'operaio, vuole il figlio dottore, e pensi che ambiente che può venir fuori, non c'è più morale contessa. Se il vento fischiava ora fischia più forte, le idee di rivolta non sono mai morte, se c'è chi lo afferma non state a sentire, è uno che vuole soltanto tradire, se c'è chi lo afferma sputategli addosso, la bandiera rossa gettato in un fosso, voi gente per bene che pace cercate, la pace per far quello che voi volete, ma se questo è il prezzo vogliamo la guerra, vogliamo vedervi finir sottoterra, ma se questo è il prezzo l'abbiamo pagato, nessuno più al mondo deve essere sfruttato, ma se questo è il prezzo l'abbiamo pagato, nessuno più al mondo deve essere sfruttato.
You can tell that this is set, that was so said with a lot of heart. You're with Annie and Tobiah on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're going to move on to a part something that's actually been happening amongst the left, discussing how they should be dealing with the US and Israeli attack aggression on Iran when they don't favour the existing government in Iran. And this leads to people needing to actually examine first principles.
Yeah, so we've played a little excerpt of this fella before. His name's Dr. Gabriel Rockhill. He's founding director of Critical Theory Workshop, which is just it's a platform where he has these conversations and he expounds. I mean, he's a professor of philosophy.
So he doesn't dodge the ball.
Yeah, he doesn't dodge the ball, and I think he takes it quite seriously. So he's responsible for writing over 12 books, the most recent of which is called Who Paid the Pipers of Western Marxism that I'm reading at the moment, and it's come under a bit of scrutiny because he sort of does a really surgical job of going through the archives and seeing what sort of academics were funded by the CIA, were instructors or had research programs funded by the CIA, mainly because they were anti-Soviet Union. So they may have been of some strain of the left, but they were serving a broader agenda of maintaining U.S.
hegemony.
The idea of U.S. hegemony, yeah. And so he, apart from being a cultural studies director at Villanova University in Philadelphia, he also does speaking tours and does a lot of this. And so this specific excerpt talks about what it's called or termed campism, which is often an accusation that's hurled at people to say that campism is reductive. Campism being that, like, the first principle is, are you anti-imperialist or are you not? And that's essentially what campism is. So saying that if you are anti-imperialism, then you realize that the first contradiction, the one that has to be dealt with, is imperialism. And then subsequent contradictions are dealt with in a different plane. You can't somehow elevate one above the other. But let's listen to
his argument.
His argument.
The way I think it's most coherent to frame some of what's going on is, I'm sure that you've seen that many in the Western left are critical of what they call campism. And they suggest that if you defend the right to armed self-defense on the part of those who are the victims of imperialism, or the right to state power, other things like this, that somehow you're getting in bed with the worst of the worst. You're involved in being in a camp with the, you know, fundamentalists and all of this. You know these arguments. What's interesting and I think very important, and something that I'm considering writing an article on, is the way in which this critique of so-called campism doesn't engage in a dialectical materialist analysis of contradictions. And this is manifest in one of the regular phrases that's used to denigrate so-called campists. They say that, well, campists think that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But that's not the position that anti-imperialists take, because it's not a moral issue and it's not a subjective question. And what they're trying to do is reduce geopolitics to something like a question of interpersonal relationships of friendship. I mean, the metaphor itself is highly revealing. From a dialectical and historical materialist point of view, what's important is to analyze different levels of conflict and struggle and identify the primary ones. The primary contradiction is between the imperialist and anti-imperialist forces in this world. Therefore, what Iran or other forces in West Asia are doing is they are pushing back against the expanse of Western and in particular US-Israeli imperialism. Therefore, it makes absolute sense to support the struggle for the liberation from imperialism, instead of attempting to make secondary contradictions, because of course there are struggles within Iran, there are struggles within the liberation struggle in Palestine, or other examples that one could point to. But if you try to make those secondary contradictions into the primary contradiction, and you say, well, what we need to do is support the people of Iran in a way that they would struggle against their state, in this particular moment, making that secondary contradiction into the primary contradiction can very easily and often does play into the hands of the imperialists, because what they want is a weakened state or oppositional force that would be much easier to divide and conquer. It's also important from a materialist vantage point to distinguish between antagonistic and non-antagonistic contradictions. The contradiction between imperialism and anti-imperialism is antagonistic. There's no way, unfortunately, of democratically resolving this. Those who are the victims of empire are constantly trying to do this, extending olive branch after olive branch, being extremely restrained in the response, begging for some type of democratic resolution. But the imperialists will not have it. Therefore, they're forced. They don't fetishize armed struggle. They don't love being bombed and you know, responding in turn. They would much rather take a different path, but they have no choice. Within that condition, The secondary contradictions, meaning the struggles within a country like Iran, often become much less, if not entirely, anti-antagonistic, meaning the forces become galvanized against the primary enemy. What this means is that what these critiques of the campist so-called position end up doing is they often try to make the secondary contradictions into primary contradictions and make them antagonistic contradictions. If you actually succeed in doing that, what you're doing is fostering dissension within the anti-imperialist camp and confusion that aids and abets, to varying degrees, depending on the positions that we're taking, the struggle to try to destroy them. We have to, I think, be very clear-eyed about what this is then. And so for those who would say that, well, Iran has the right to self-defense, it shouldn't be bombed into the Stone Ages, or its civilization should not be eliminated, these genocidal forces should be held at bay, this does not mean that the person who proffers this position is saying, I support absolutely everything that Iran has or will ever do. I'm getting in bed with these people. I'm friends with these people, or anything along those lines. This is the reduction of a complex set of contradictions that need to be understood at a materialist and dialectical level to a moralizing subjectivism that is rooted in the idea that, well, what I support is the same thing as what I am, this kind of consumerist relationship to politics. I say Iran has a right to self-defense, therefore I am a supporter of everything Iranian or everything that the Iranian state represents. No, what I'm doing is I'm engaging in a materialist analysis, recognizing that we have to privilege the primary contradiction, recognize secondary and tertiary contradictions, also support struggles within various countries or movements to move things in a more progressive direction, but also be very clear-eyed about what it means at one point in time to support and make primary the principal contradiction, and how we need to shelve the kind of moralist subjectivism of those ultimately, whether they know they're doing it or not, they're serving at an intellectual level at a minimum the interests of empire by trying to divide and confuse those who are opposed to imperialism.
You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM, the voice of the community.
And you're with Annie and Tobias on Solidarity Breakfast, and we've got Sue Bolton on the line. G'day, Sue. How are you?
Hi, how's it going?
Good. We're being very highbrow there for a minute, talking about why it's important to fight anti-imperialism. But you've decided as a long-term Marybeck councillor to fight imperialism by putting your hat in the ring for the Victorian election.
Yes, I have. I'll be standing in the seat of Broadmeadows at the end of this year. Broadmeadows covers the top part of the Marybeck Council, like the northern strip of suburbs, Faulkner, Hadfield, Glenroy, but then also includes the other side of the Western Ring Road, Broadmeadows, Campbellfield, Coolaroo, up to Somerton Road. Oh, so where actually a lot of people in Faulkner have been forced to because of the high cost of housing in Faulkner.
Oh, well, that's very interesting, because as you say, you one of the reasons for why it's so important for you to be doing this is because you believe that the Albanese Labor government has failed to address the interests of working people, and that they need a radical left-wing alternative.
That's right. That's why I'm standing, and Socialist Alliance is standing in the area. We'll also have a number of candidates in Geelong and the upper house in the northern suburbs, the northern metropolitan and the Cedar Pasco Vale. So we'll be standing in a few places. And I think, Labor, both federal and state, you know, we see time and time again how they're not the representative of working class people, really. So there absolutely needs to be a left alternative to this.
You're being quite strategic, aren't you? The Socialist Alliance is being quite strategic in the choices of seats that you're going for.
I think partly we have built up a lot of support in especially the two lower house seats that we're standing in Melbourne, and our Geelong branch has been very active in Geelong, like really if there's anything progressive happening in Geelong, it's usually our comrades who've been at the heart of getting something going.
Yeah.
Sometimes things might be initiated by others and we'll come in and support them. But, yeah, our, you know, like going way back to the Work Choices campaign in 2005 and those massive protests, but also on all sorts of issues since then around queer rights and Palestine and like lots and lots of issues. Yeah.
So tell me, what are the key issues for Broadmeadows?
I think for Broadmeadows, the eastern side of Broadmeadows, the upfield train line is a really massive issue. In fact, anyone who lives north of Bell Street on the upfield train line, you run the risk of cancellations at peak hour because there's only a single track north of Faulkner. And that means that trains can't pass each other. So as soon as there's 6 minutes late, they're cancelled, which if, you know, one or two trains are cancelled at peak hour, then it means people late to work and risk losing their job. But also for people who live north of Faulkner, there's no station apart from the station at the end, the upfield station. So there's nothing in between. There used to be a station at Campbellfield until the late 50s when they demolished it. And so there's real human beings who live and work in Campbellfield and the eastern side of Broadmeadows, Dulles area, et cetera. And there's no station they can get on at. There really should be two stations between the upfield station and Gary station in Faulkner. I think there's a lot of fear in the city of Broadmeadows, like there is everywhere, about, you know, people's ability to afford to live. And so I think, you know, cost of living is a big issue for most people everywhere, but probably, you know, less in richer part of towns and of the town and areas like Broadmeadows. You know, people are very much a victim to job cuts as well as low wages and the casualisation of work, and all of that plays into people not being able to afford housing, whether it's rental housing or buying a house. And then we've got the fact that state government is still trying to get away with demolishing the public housing towers. And while there's no public housing towers in Broadmeadows, like, the impact of that will flow on. And while there might be a lot of people who don't think about public housing because there's so little public housing nowadays in Victoria and across Australia, a lot of people don't have any experience of public housing, that public housing is something that governments can do. And so a lot of people don't necessarily see it as a solution because they've grown up in an environment where the only thing they've ever known is housing being organised through the market, access to housing being organised through the market. And the market's been disastrous.
Yeah, it's an engineered lack of housing for lower paid and lower income people.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think the housing issue is really, really big.
Yeah.
It's not necessary. I mean, we will absolutely be campaigning for building more public housing because that's the only way you can solve the issues. You can't solve housing through the market. But there's also an issue of having to raise awareness around that issue because a lot of people are not aware of...
That there's a way out.
Yeah, of this as being an answer.
The other thing about those suburbs in particular, it strikes me a similar element to being, say, in the bush, where there's this idea that governments just don't know what it's like to live in these places. And so they make rules that have no positive effect for people in, say, the bush or even in Broadmeadows, even though Broadmeadows is actually part of Melbourne.
That's right. That's right. And
The reason why I bring that up is because of the issue of things like wanting to put in incinerators, for example, or the chemical fires because they've built factories that are not being regulated properly, but they've put them out into the west or out towards Broadmeadows because they believe that they're out of sight, out of mind.
That's right. They believe people won't do anything about it. And the plans for a wallet incinerator will absolutely affect people in Broadmeadows if it goes ahead. And Sunbury, I'm not sure that it would, you know, that's part of the Hume Council, which Broadmeadows is part of the Hume Council. Sunbury is not part of the Broadmeadows electorate. But, you know, yeah, they're also, their community campaigns against the wallet and Sunbury proposals for incinerators. But also, like, the Hume Council is grappling with the issue. I think the applications are for outside of the Broadmeadows electorate, but in the outer northern suburbs, for a data processing centre, which, of course, the data processing centres, as they're popping up around the world to, you know, fund, to power AI... are really running places out of water.
And also increasing the cost of electricity across the board.
Yeah. So, like...
They're not our friend.
That's right. So this is an issue that Hume Council is having to deal with, and there's very little, as far as I can see, regulation of this issue in particular.
No, that's right. In fact, it's fascinating to me that, in fact, data centres are ringing Melbourne now, like, and even down in Port Melbourne, places like that, and there's very, very little discussion about it on legacy media, despite the fact that it's going to change people's lives. We're paying for our own subjugation.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, there will be a massive increase in the use of electricity, which you're right, that will flow into higher electricity bills, and then also the usage of water is incredible. And in a sense, they now I don't know what sort of charges they pay for water, but I imagine governments will, you know, give them. Capitalist governments, that's what we've got, will be, rolling out the red carpet to these data processing centres.
Well, they've already done it.
And we've already seen them do it to gas companies, a bipartisan refusal to impose any sort of taxation. So we can probably pretty safely assume that these will go on to whatever AI mates and other related industries, like the companies running the incinerators, will face the same little scrutiny that the gas companies do as well.
Waste to energy. That's their motto, isn't it? So this is why it's really important that you, as a socialist, put your hand up, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And the other thing is that the Allan government, there has been some campaigning against the state government over Palestine and supporting an MOU or being part of an MOU with the Israeli Defence Force and funding a project for Elbit Systems, one of the big weapons manufacturers in Israel. Now, the Elbit Systems project has been built now with government money, and so that project's no longer something being funded. And the MOU with the Israeli Defence Force has run out, so they haven't renewed that. No doubt that was a result, a bit of a win in a sense, for the Palestine movement. But what the government is doing, the Victorian government, separately to the federal government, is they are funding, pumping massive amounts of money into weapons manufacturers in Victoria, in particular around Geelong. And in fact, Geelong is being turned into a weapons manufacturing hub, including the old Ford factory in Geelong. So this is something which, we are saying that the funding, the bankrolling of weapons manufacturing needs to be shifted out of weapons manufacturing and going to other uses, social uses.
Well, it's interesting you should bring this up because what they've done, in fact, is over a decade or longer, the federal and state government and its bipartisan have locked Australian manufacturing into the war industry. They've created a suburb of America in actual terms, because it's unnecessary for us to be tied to defence manufacturing. They've decided to do it, basically. And they've impoverished areas like in policy, like Geelong and Broadmeadows and places like this. And, of course, then they say there is jobs in defence manufacturing, despite the fact we don't, with the latest war, Israeli-US aggression, we're now told that there are a whole range of products that are required for construction, like polyurethane piping, for example. Like, we're going to run out of that and you require it for plumbing, right? Now, they stopped manufacturing that locally because we're part of the international world economy, although we could actually be manufacturing it here. So we could actually have a non-defence manufacturing industry in Australia. We don't need to be a suburb of America.
Well, that is absolutely true. It was a choice, and it was absolutely a choice. And I think it might have started under the Scott Morrison government.
Yeah.
When he wanted Australia to be one of the top 10 weapons manufacturers in the world. So it was a deliberate policy. Might have started earlier than that, but
I don't think the Labor Party is adverse to doing this sort of bullshit as well.
That's right. Well, they've just followed on from that. There are a lot of things that Australia could manufacture. And if there are certain things which are really important, and there's no private company prepared to manufacture, then the government can also run manufacturing. They used to do government manufacturing for defence. And
they used to build public housing.
That's right. So the Australian government used to make defence uniforms and police uniforms and so forth. They used to have a government aircraft factory, ammunition factory, et cetera. Now, okay, those are all war-related, but what it proves is it is possible to, do manufacturing for civilian purposes that is run by the government.
Yeah, and the point being is that if a person of your political ilk actually, and going back to what you were saying about public housing being an alternative that people in the Broadmeadows electorate are unaware of, having people in Parliament who can actually articulate alternatives to these mainstream messages would be so good.
And vitally important, because I think one of the strengths of your campaign, even I'm thinking of the last one you ran in the seat of Wills, was that not only do you speak about the big issues, and I'm just recalling the memory of it's been 1 year since Gaetano Greco passed this week, and I'm just thinking of what he would often say was that your political persuasion is almost irrelevant to normal people, and what people want to do is that they want to have the lights working, no holes in the road, and access to public transport. And I think that's one of the campaigns that you lead quite well, is that you can talk about these big industries like, you know, war-related spending in federal governments and the access to public transport, but also you're actually quite connected to workers at a ground level, you know, council workers that are standing up for their rights in the ASU campaign, and many other issues like the environment, access to bike lanes. I've seen you at almost everything in the Marybeck area that supports a social cause.
Yeah, I think that is important to be able to defend people's rights regardless of which level of government or big business is involved in trampling over people's rights to a basic functioning society. And I think that that is really important because people have so many things that piss them off in society, but people aren't necessarily in the space of being able to campaign around everything. I mean, some things might just affect them and not really anyone else, like some sort of injustice or, you know, something not working that makes life really difficult. But you know, certainly where there is, you know, there's something that affects, you know, a range of people, whether it is around, you know, an unsafe road or something else. I think the way I sort of do things is I try and bring people together who might be affected by that issue, and so that people are speaking with one voice. And I think that's really important. I mean, this sort of goes to what I do on the council, is I try and get people organised to be able to speak for themselves and not just speaking through me, but speaking on their own behalf. And in the, certainly, I think, you know, even in, you know, standing for a state seat, you know, my intention, especially if I got elected, but is to do something similar in the electorate, in state government and so forth, because, you know, we need people to see that they can there's a way that they can change things in society and not just speak through politicians. I think that is really, really important. And when people come together with a common interest, whether it is a workplace dispute like a strike or industrial action or whatever, or some other issue, then unless you're united, you're not going to win. And so in order to be united, it means that people have to overcome their different prejudices and so forth. And so that's probably the best way of overcoming prejudice and discrimination, when people come together collectively to fight for something. When we've got all of these forces, mainstream politicians, but also, you know, the far right that's busy trying to tell people that migrants are the cause of the housing crisis. And if that was true, we would have had dirt cheap housing during COVID and we didn't have dirt cheap housing. It was very expensive still.
Well, you know, it's always about misdirection. They're a magic act, aren't they? They're rich. They're always directing people's eyes to some other direction other than them as the culprit.
That's right.
Well, good luck with your campaign, and we'll keep an eye on what you're doing, Sue. Thanks very much for talking to us this morning.
Thanks, Annie. Thanks. Bye.
I am the land. I'm the trees and the rivers. Joining and moving.
Solidarity Brekkie team listener, when that bastion of socialist courage and dedication, well, he doesn't make a point of it, but he was raised in public housing by a single mum and led the Parliamentary Friends of Palestine, until it mattered. Yes, Big Supremo Anthony Albanese celebrated May Day by warning, quote, warning evil unions not to upset their caring employers. The great world resource behemoths in the Pilbara, where caring employers and lazy Aboriginal workers have coexisted in win-win harmony for decades without the unnecessary disruption of evil unions. Anthony warned evil unions not to abuse industrial powers, because we know in caring business class relations all the power lies with unions and workers. You only have workers and union members if you have successful businesses, Anthony saged. Goodness, the great resource behemoth's caring employers couldn't have put it better. That's why they need to work together with common interests and not abuse any privileges which are there. Anthony didn't outline what privileges are there, but shades of his socialist predecessor, Nuclear Hawk himself, getting Troubler Aussie together. And didn't that work a treat? The Western Troubler Aussie Chamber of Minerals and Energy Profits said, union action, for which we read union existence, threatens, undermines Troubler Aussie's bargaining position for fuel amid the current Middle East crisis. There. The fuel problem has nothing to do with capitalism. It's the workers and evil unions yet again. To make matters worse, the Western Mine Workers Alliance claimed workers in the Pilbara have seen their wages fall well behind cost of living increases over the past decade. As if. Can't be true, because the caring employers point out keeping unions out creates a win-win scenario. Yes, how's that work? We asked. Well, we win and we win. Well, yeah, that's win-win. So thanks, Anthony, for celebrating May Day with a large dose of working class solidarity. But we couldn't expect less. The great resource behemoths were also celebrating after Anthony assured them the socialists would not tax gas, summed up beautifully by a Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin headline, huge print, gas tax relief. Then kicker, Woodside with profits welcomes Albanese decision to avoid levy on LNG exports. That says it all, doesn't it? Another courageous socialist capitulation. some long-haired commie, greenie, wooden working an eye and anti-progress disruptors might think gas tax relief should mean relief for the public purse, but Anthony knows that's not the socialist thing to do. And we all know the positive role Western Trooper Aussie Supremo Roger Cook the Planet plays in ensuring we have more and more and more gas from which to transition from gas. Well, this week, Roger made yet another compassionate, caring contribution to the socialist cause. As slaughter and destruction and genocide and starvation continue apace across the so-called Middle East, itself a colonial nomenclature, Roger saw a silver lining in all that slaughter. We can cash in on the rupture of global supply chains. He rubbed his hands together on behalf of Woodside with Santos Us the Prophets et al. Exciting news, Roger. Exciting prophets. Keep the killing going. Making a killing here and making a killing everywhere, really, the technology behemoths we learned Google and Meta siphoned $11 billion out of Troubadour Aussie transferred to overseas entities which happened to be themselves and sadly weren't able to pay tax on all their massive profits because they weren't able to pay tax on all their massive profits. Not quite true. They paid something like 0.00% of their exorbitant profits, ensuring they met their legal tax obligations. Although they are upset that Anthony has mooted a tax on them if they don't reach an agreement with the huge mainstream media behemoths, technical giants versus media giants. Who do we barrack for? Elon must have more or Lord Rupert a whopping? Question. If Lord Rupert wins the battle, obtains the new income, how much of the new income stream will the workers who produce the news content see? But good on Anthony for also celebrating May Day by supporting Lord Rupert. When US of the UN of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor, meets our head of state. No, listen, Donald is not yet our official head of state. Unofficial, okay, but not yet. Our head of state, his most gracious majesty, it's hard to know who to feel sorry for. Well, let's face it, neither, because they deserve each other. But the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin thought the state dinner so important, it published a full list of dinner guests, a motley collection of trample the poor sycophants, and or filthy rich of the filthy rich caring business class and trample the poor nepotic family all make zillions out of Donald's caring business class policies or what passes policies. And notice one of the biggest getting filthy richer beneficiaries, Donald's son-in-law, Jared Cashing Narin, was described as the honourable. And I thought, in what universe has Jared become honourable? Horrible, okay, but honourable, unless making squillions out of nepotism qualifies. Then again, if we look at all the people referred to as the honourable, then yeah, Jared probably does qualify. And what a pity we're not US of citizens. We miss out on Donald's latest gift to the nation. With his customary modesty, the Don will celebrate the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence with US of passports featuring his face against a background of national and state symbols with his signature in gold. And his signature will also appear on banknotes, a first for a sitting big supremo, trample the poor land. The Whopping Sin devoted almost an entire page with huge picky Monday to a protest over war crimes charges against poor Ben Robert Smudge the Bad Guys. Picky showing exactly two people holding a huge banner. And the Whopping Sin said about 300 people carried on about the miscarriage of justice. Now, Palestine rallies attract many, many more crowds than that, yet only get a mention if something controversial occurs with which the Whopping Sin Lord Rupert feel they can attack it. Get a whole page about the injustice of charging an alleged war criminal rather than letting justice take its course. This followed the cloying day after day wall-to-wall celebration of a military disaster. And shame, shame, the evil CFMEU took Monday off, even though there was no public holiday in Victoria, prompting the righteously disgusted Whopping Sin to headline Honour Anzacs by bludging. Shame, workers, shame. Other states did have a public holiday, so obviously every worker in those states is a bludger. Shame, all workers, shame. gambling giant Tab Weacop Yours has banned 8 professional punters who broke the rules by winning, that is, consistently winning more than they were losing. We had no choice, Tab Weacop Supremo Gil McClock then explained. They displayed total disregard for the interests of our shareholders. So people can bet as long as they don't win. Absolutely, we welcome them with open arms, bringing us back to Donald. As we know, the World Cup is imminent, hosted by North America. Trample the poor Canada, trample the poor Mexico, and trample the poor US of. And soccer-mad Italy failed to qualify, while evil Iran did qualify. But what's that matter? Donald now says Italy should be reinstated and replace Iran. Forget the rules, which the Don knows are spelt, trample the poor. After all, the sycophants at FIFA, the world football body, greased Donald with some confected peace medal or other in honour of all the people he has slaughtered in just 15 months. Getting slaughtered financially, apparently, poor Harry Trigubov, who I think is Triple Aussie's second or third richest person behind our Gina. Oh, and as a by-the-by, let's recommend that No Notions That Appalling Hoonsun pilot her own plane. Thanks, Gina. Poor Harry, our biggest property developer, is a victim of the housing crisis. The Prudential Regulation Authority is making life almost impossible for developers. He spoke for all of us. It must be reformed. Poor Harry, a housing crisis. Still, he struggles on his trillions. Finally, as the first report lands from the Bondi His Most Gracious Majesty's Commission, another dedicated socialist, New South Wales Supremo Chris Minghi, responded, "We must stop hate spilling into terrorism." Well said, Chris, who must have realised their actions display the hate his constabulary must have for long-haired commie protesters. Happy May Day. Good morning.
Play-based, culturally safe early learning is available in Victoria and sets our kids up for life. That's why Koori Kids can access 15 hours of funded 3-year-old kindergarten a week. And to give our kids even more opportunities to socialise and learn through play, from 2026, 4-year-old kindergarten hours will increase up to 25 hours a week. Together, we can give our Koori Kids the best start. Search Koori Kids Shine to learn more. Authorised by the Victorian Government, Melbourne. A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM, the voice of the community.
And you're with Annie and Tobiah on Solidarity Breakfast. And we're going to finish off with a few speeches from last night's May the 1st celebration of International Workers' Day. It was held outside State Library, and as the huge amounts of crowds were around, it was a perfect point to raise your voice for
Welcome, comrades, to this May Day rally. We gather as just one of the many millions rallying around the world today to advance the struggle of workers. My name is Davey Heller, and I'm a member of the Red Anti-Imperialist Collective, and I'm the MC of today's rally. Our first speaker is Tasneem from the Free and Palestine Coalition. And Tasneem was involved also in the NTU for Palestine. She's played a leading role in organising both mass rallies and worker union actions against the genocide in Gaza. Please welcome Tasneem.
Hello everyone, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respect to elders past and present. Always was, always will be. Always was, always will be. I'd like to acknowledge the workers' movement as well, and that of course includes Indigenous resistance, because Indigenous people around the world are the underclass of society, are the ones who've been placed at the bottom. And from the bottom, that is where revolution begins, and that is where victory will be afforded. So I want to repeat that chant. There is only one solution. There is only one solution. And of course that chant is from the chant, one solution, revolution. So this is what we speak about when we're commemorating and marking May Day as an anti-imperialist war. This is a time of anti-imperialism. there are many, many fronts of war being launched by the imperialists, facing an asymmetrical battle of existence by peoples who are subjugated, who are fighting for their lives. And that is something that workers of the world relate to. Because when we say we are the side of life, we are the teachers, we're the nurses, we're the hospital workers, that is what we're fighting for. And we shouldn't see any division between us and the people under the bombs. The people under the bombs are the ones fighting for life. And so any discussion about the role of the labor movement needs to begin there. Who are we and what are we fighting for? Often the struggle is diminished and demonized as the antagonistic side, right? As the side that is bringing violence. But that is not our understanding of struggle. What we understand is to end violence, we need to fight back. And we need to defeat the imperialists. We need to defend ourselves, defend our hospitals, defend our schools, speak the truth, defend our media. And I'm proud to be of a people, the people of Gaza, the people of Palestine, who demonstrate that to the whole world. And that is something that I honor, as I honor May Day as well. When we talk about May Day, we're talking about welfare. We're talking about free healthcare. We're talking about free education. That is our side, and there's no equivocation about it. What is the other side, though? And what kind of world do they offer to us? The Trumps, the fascists, those who are celebrating Ben Roberts, celebrating war criminals. War criminals who are trying to evade even the slightest bit of accountability. And it's not that John Howard will be held accountable for war crimes. It's not like the United States and the United Kingdom will be held accountable for any of the devastation, the millions of lives, the blood on their hands. And yet even the prosecution of one soldier can ignite so much fragility and so much claim to innocence from the side of the warmongers. So we know who we are, though we stand for struggle, and there's no equivocation about it, though we stand for resistance, we are the side of life. We are the side of hope. We are the side that will build a future on that premise. So here's to that, and free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Free, free Iran.
Free, free Iran.
Free, free Iran. Free, free Lebanon.
Free, free Lebanon.
Free, free Lebanon.
Free, free Sudan.
Free, free Sudan.
Free, free Sudan.
Free, free
Congo.
Free, free Congo.
Free, free Congo.
Freedom to all oppressed people, freedom to all workers exploited and whose wages are stolen. Freedom to the indigenous peoples of this land. Thank you.
I'd like to welcome to the stage. It's Jonathan Sherlock from Solidarity and from the Teachers for Palestine and a union militant. Welcome.
The same system raining death on Iran, Lebanon and Palestine is the system driving up fuel and food prices all over the world for workers and pushing the global south towards famine. That's why we need to fight to break Labor's support for US imperialism. We demand to break the US alliance, cancel the AUKUS agreement and close Pine Gap and any other US bases on Australian soil. But we also need to bring the fight into our unions and workplaces to take on the main enemy, Australia's homegrown capitalism. Taking the fight to Albanese also means taking up the fight to the Victorian ALP government. Australia's support for Israel goes hand in hand with their imperialist strategy of being a reliable ally to the USA so that Australia can rely on the backing of the USA in its own projection of power, particularly into the Pacific. This motivates the Victorian government to repress school staff who bring Palestine into the classroom and into our workplaces. The Victorian government is responsible for suspending students, giving directives to stand down staff, removing kafirs and telling teachers not to talk about Palestine to students, which, by the way, is a ridiculous demand, especially when the Victorian curriculum explicitly contains politics as part of the humanities. And perhaps more importantly, Palestinian students and staff are in our schools and their families are in Gaza and the West Bank, and they need our support in our workplaces not to be silenced. Soon after 7th October 2023 and the Al-Aqsa flood, school staff who support Palestine got together to form Teachers and School Staff for Palestine. And I want to emphasise we are no heroes, we were terrified. We were wondering about the pressure the government would put on us to not speak out, that we would be slammed for shoving our political views down students' throats. So we had to be clear, we needed to be a union group, members of the Australian Education Union or the Independent Education Union. This meant we sought union protection for speaking out, and also that we would commit to talking to fellow union members, building our movement, because there is safety in numbers and power in our union movement. We found many sympathetic fellow AAU members and started passing motions in workplaces and at regional meetings where members and delegates from across workplaces come together to network. We talked to the AAU leadership about the AAU explicitly supporting Palestine. Initially, the AAU leadership resisted our calls, protesting that they were getting heat from both sides, by which we took to mean that the ALP was pressuring them because the AAU leadership are all ALP members. But the weekly rallies, the grassroots workplace motions and discussions with colleagues built a habit of activism among a small core group of activists. We got used to arguing about the connection between the genocide in Palestine and our local communities, from our Palestinian students and staff who are directly affected through to Australia building a war budget through cuts to essential services. After building a grassroots movement in this way, we were determined to take a resolution to Branch Conference, the sovereign body of the Australian Education Union. We carried the day on the conference floor, and the official AAU position became support of Palestine and against the genocide. AAU staff told activists that it was a breath of fresh air, bringing debate confidently and in a comradely manner into the heart of the union, giving our conference life again. This in turn gave more protection for activists to speak out and had the almost immediate effect of getting the Department of Education to withdraw its objection to school staff wearing kafirs in solidarity with Palestine. This means when we started campaigning for a new agreement recently, there were many activists who were networked and ready to campaign to strike. The last agreement was put to a vote with no industrial action at all. It was a disaster, with thousands of AAU members resigning. But members have now joined the AAU again in record numbers since the strike was announced. In fact, it has been the largest growth by the AAU in its history, and perhaps of any union in Australia's history. Teachers who started as activists for Palestine are now campaigning for a better agreement and for a better education system in this state. Now, we need to be clear about something. The 35% pay rise we are asking for over 3 years is not an ambit claim. This is a wage claim that we see as a minimum to make up for the heavy losses of pay in real terms over the last agreement. The Labor government has decided to play dirty, announcing an offer of 28% over 4 years via a leak from the minister's office. This was designed to make teachers look ungrateful to the Victorian public. They got the Herald Sun headlines they wanted, but no one else is listening. While pay is centrally important to our new agreement, it is also about reforming Victorian education so that we have conditions where teachers are not burning out. We need smaller class sizes, more planning time, paid lunch breaks for our support staff. Instead, the Victorian government is pushing a workload index scheme that is complex and not transparent, while spending money on getting arms and submarine programs into school, to prep schools, students for serving in the military. Sorry, this fight for a pay rise that makes real gains against inflation is taking place in the context of rising oil and fuel prices that is in turn raising the prices of everything. This has been caused by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz by the USA's attack on Iran, which Australia backs through the provision of a spy plane and intelligence via Pine Gap. So in fighting the Victorian government, working hand in hand with the Australian government, we have to take on the imperialism inherent in Australian capitalism. Every fight is now connected to the fight against Australian imperialism. The school staff fight for a pay rise, for proper funding for our schools, connected. The fight for a properly funded NDIS that serves human need, not corporate greed, connected. The fight for aged care places, for domestic violence services, for hospital and public health, all connected. They are all connected to the fight against spending billions of dollars on weapons so that a few rich capitalists can protect their power. At the end of the day, as teachers and school staff on strike, we are not just demanding pay and conditions, we are asking the question of what our education system should really look like. Should it remain a place where our most vulnerable students are placed on a school-to-prison pipeline? Should it be a place where Palestinian voices are repressed while imperialist voices are amplified? We believe it is one where we get the time to spend with our students, treating them with respect and patience, which we then get in return, and that we have the planning time to think strategically about how best to teach them. The US empire is in decline. As workers, we can build in our workplace a struggle for a new society. We have a world to win. Thank you.
I'm going to introduce Izzy from Lasnet to say a few words.
Hello, everyone. My name is Isidro. I am part of the Latin American Solidarity Network. I'm here standing in global solidarity because I'm not from here, I'm not from there, and we're all a little bit from everywhere at all. We're all a little bit from everywhere and not and from nowhere at all. Our struggle is common across borders. And like Comrade Abbas just said, the Greater Israel Project is expanding on its borders. Right now, it's affecting also my people in South America, in Chile, in Ecuador, in Argentina. They are jailing indigenous leaders without a fair trial. The leader of the Pueblo Quitucara was recently arrested just 3 weeks ago with no crime, no conviction. They just disappeared him. It would be a dishonor to not mention my country, Ecuador. Right now, Ecuador has been affected by the Zionist lobby as well. Our president is a gringo. Our president of the assembly is training the IDF. Our minister of foreign relations is dual citizen Israeli. And our president of the defense forces is also dual citizen Israeli. They are dispossessing all the people in the Amazon and in the Andes, ancestral communes that have existed before we even had a name for something like communism. They are trying to take away not only the natural resources, but the spirit of the land. That's why I make a call to all the collectives present to align with the indigenous struggle. Because although most leftists are atheists or don't believe in a higher power, we are here welcome to this country. This country, in one way or another, has embraced us. That's why Aboriginal leaders, the first thing they do is a welcome to country. You've all been welcome here to fight for this country. In my country, we call nature Pachamama, Mother Nature. And I tell you, your mother is calling. It's being pillaged and raped by the global capital elite. And we cannot let that happen. If you are here standing, you know what you need to do. You know what your beliefs are. And you know you're not alone. In the coming years, the war against the people will get more violent because poverty is violence. We see this war with every hiking price of groceries and fuel. Even those who call themselves privileged are suffering for this war is against everyone. In my country, we call everyone, we say that everyone is a neighbor, because we're all neighbors. Some are close to us, some others are far away. But meet your neighbors, talk to them, ask if they need help. You never know what they are going through. You never know what a willing eye or a willing ear can change the life of someone. And we need to stand with each other. Together we stand, divided we fall. I'm just gonna end this with a chant, first in English, then in Spanish. The people united will never be defeated. The people united will never be defeated. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. Hasta la victoria siempre. Until victory forever.
Victory forever.
Absolutely.
What a great speech.
Beautiful. A rousing, rousing speech.
Yeah, yeah. That was May Day celebrations yesterday outside State Library.
Couple of events for tomorrow. Obviously, the May Day...
At Victoria Trades Hall outside. They do it every year, the first Sunday of May. It starts at 12:30 with speeches at 1. Rally march through the streets at 2 and back again at 3 for more speeches. There will be a 3CR outside broadcast between and, 2 and 4.
And later that day at the MUA Auditorium, 46 to 54 Island Street, West Melbourne, there'll be a concert for Timor-Leste, 3:30 to 7:30 p.m. The union, the MUA and Union Aid Abroad, AFIDA, will be proudly presenting an afternoon full of music, food and fundraising. There'll be music curated by Paulie Stewart of the Painters and Dockers, so get down to that. And then later in the week... on Tuesday at 10 a.m., you can join the mass strike with the ASU.
Oh, yeah.
Out front of Trades Hall.
Council workers.
Yeah, support Melbourne Metropolitan Council workers from 10 a.m. with an 11 a.m. march to Parliament. And Annie, what song are we going out with today?
A Perfect Day. Lou Reed. Coming up next, Asia Pacific Currents.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in the park. And then later, when it gets dark, we go home. Just a perfect day. Feed animals in the zoo. Then later, a movie too, and then home. Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep. Just a perfect day. Problems all left alone. Weekenders on our own. It's such fun. Just a perfect day. You made me forget myself. I thought I was someone else, someone good. Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep me hanging on. Hanging on.
listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.